ってます。
So I wanted, what's helpful for me is to get some questions. You know, it challenges me. And then I get to say I don't know. And then I can go home and think about it and come back with an answer. So that's all. That's very encouraging and stimulating for me. So I'm encouraging you to help me out with your questions. Okay? Do you have any? Do you have any just general questions? I mean, during the week, I'm sure you run into things like that you don't understand about Buddhism, or you disagree with, you know, or you struggle with, you know, anything from your posture or to something. And I always appreciate Barbara because she is, she's fearless. She's fearless. And what's really great about her questions is she, you know, most people don't ask questions because they're afraid, you know, somebody's going to say, well, that's such a, you know, question. But you're always asking the question for somebody else. Remember that. It's a real bodhisattva activity. You're putting yourself out there. Somebody else has this question also, you know. So it's great. And the simpler the questions, generally, the better. You know, I always look forward to it, Barbara. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That for
yes. A little preamble there.
There are a lot of different flavors of Buddhism.
Yeah.
And aside from impermanence and suffering, are there any other things that they all agree on or coalesce with? Does everybody honor and use the Heart Sutra, the Metta Sutra? Those would be the things that come to mind for me, but I wonder if that's because I've been practicing with your guidance, or whether it is, those are kind of universal Buddhist.
What was you had one couple words there I didn't quite get. Something about my guidance?
I think of the Metta Sutra and the Heart Sutra because
right.
I've been practicing
yeah.
with your
guidance. Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
But
yeah.
Not all the other Buddhists.
Yeah.
Until
yeah. Good, wonderful point. Yes, lots of different flavors. And also very much flavored by the cultural context in which they arose. So Indian Buddhism, early Indian Buddhism, very strongly influenced by the Vedantic tradition, you know, the Vedicas, the Hinduism, right? Very strongly influenced by that. And the mind and the temperament of the Indian. So the earlier teachings will reflect that. Like in the Abhidharma, the emphasis, and then various schools. There's like, you know, seven or eight different major schools that arose within 200 or 300 years after Buddha. You know, all had a different flavor, you know. But generally, the flavors kind of break down into two main categories. One is kind of like the earlier teachings and the earlier sutras, and that's usually called the Theravadan tradition, or the teaching of the elders, right? And then later on, as I've explained, as Buddhism began to develop, and they wanted to expand it beyond just to use of the monks. The thing is, well, not just monks can be liberated. How about just householders that have children? Can't they practice the Buddhist teachings and gain some real benefit from that? So these other sutras began to develop 300 or 400 years after the Buddha, and those are called the Prajnaparamita sutras. Or the Lotus Sutra. The Heart Sutra is part of that tradition. And so that emphasizes a much more kind of expansive way of holding the teachings. And so when we study the Heart Sutra and the Lotus Sutra and those kinds of sutras, those are ones that develop later. And the way that was explained was that Buddha actually did teach these, but that the people really needed to practice these basic teachings of, you know, like concentration and to get their minds ready for these later teachings. So that's one answer part of your question. The other part is there anything they hold as a universal truth? Well, I would say they hold as a universal truth that Buddha had something to teach that was important. That he was very interested in relieving suffering, and so you start with they almost all agree in the Four Noble Truths, which are the very earliest teachings. There is suffering. There's a way to get around suffering. What causes suffering is the attachment, you know, to the self and your narrow point of view, and then the Eightfold Path, you know, which permeates out through all the teachings. Those are very, very core teachings, you know. So I would say the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and then from there it depends on the various schools. Some emphasize some of those and others emphasize others. Some tend to emphasize meditation more, like Zen tends to emphasize meditation as a core practice, but there are many schools, like especially some of the contemporary newer schools in Japan, that don't. They just said meditation is a little too hard for most people. Can't we just do it through ethics or just kind of a faith practice? So there really is a tremendous difference in the various schools, and especially there's a great cultural difference. Tibet brings in their early shamanistic traditions and imprints that on Buddhism, and Buddhism absorbed it. Buddhism goes to China, and it absorbs some of the Confucian ethics, and especially Taoism. Zen is really a merger of Indian Buddhism and Taoism. And then you go to Japan, and in the whole Japanese culture, the forms in Zen have a lot to do, especially Japanese Zen, because Zen also is from China, has a lot to do with kind of the cultural way the Japanese are, that's comfortable for them. So does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, I think the answer is that it's no matter where we were to travel in Buddhism, we would find the Four Noble Truths in the Eightfold.
I think so. I think you would. I don't know of any. Some would emphasize it more than others, but you would find that. You'd probably also find the three marks of Buddhism, which is the doctrine of kind of no self, meaning that our idea of self is pretty limited, not that we don't have a self, but the idea is very limited, and that would be one. Two, impermanence, the whole idea of impermanence, that anything, any idea that you have is impermanent, and because of that, any one idea that you hang on to is connected to actually, you know, the flow and stream of all things. So that's why in meditation, when we actually practice observing the reality of impermanence, thoughts come, thoughts go, physical sensations come and they go, more and more we deepen this idea that things aren't so solid. The idea of self isn't so solid. The idea of anything, it just comes, it goes, it flows, it's all together, it's part of a bigger thing that we call, we don't, you know, just we're reluctant to label whatever that is. We could call it emptiness. We could call it the Dharmakaya. We could call it, as close as we get to calling, you know, our concept of God. We've been studying Dogen's Time Being. The more I read Dogen's Time Being, I realize it's just his way of, another way of talking about emptiness, actually. He's trying to get us to see it through the lens of time being, of time. So, yes, Steve.
Would another way to say that be everything changes? That, you know, phrase that you've used.
That's pretty universal. I would say almost all Buddhists would agree on that concept. Tibetans, you know, Zen, all different schools, about the doctrine of impermanence and how that. When somebody asks Suzuki Roshi once, could you just summarize all Buddhist teachings in one thing? What would that one thing be? And he said impermanence. Because the doctrine of no self and the insubstantiality of things and codependent origination, all things are connected, emptiness, that all stems from this idea of emptiness, which is what we're really studying. Yes, Ron?
This has to do with early Buddhism. I've been reading some of the early suttas, the earliest writings or having to do with Buddhist teaching in his life. And what struck me was there are so many things that occur today that we would say are preternatural or, I guess, paranormal, or even you'd say, you know, miracles and signs and miracles kind of thing. And and the way they describe it is just routine. Matter of fact, this happened, you know, and this happened. And what I'm wondering is, do you think in Buddha's day there was sort of varieties of religious experience that were open to them, that they experienced, that because we live now in a material scientific world that we can no longer access or apprehend. Or the other alternative is that all that was just kind of tall tales that got kind of, you know, attached to it in later centuries. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, let me ask you, are you referring in your research that there are things that are close to miracles? Is that what you mean?
Things that occur routinely that... Yeah, miracles or just paranormal experiences.
Like, give me an example of what you remember.
Well, there's Buddha had, you know, they had display. There was one thing that is the cities or these paranormal abilities they had to, what's it called, far vision or to, you know, to levitate and this and that.
Uh-huh.
But more important, the first two knowledges of Buddha when he experienced enlightenment was this very vivid description of
past lives.
Past lives is another example.
Yeah, there's a good...
But there's others, and if you read like the early suttas of things that go on that are just routine. They're not like, they don't contain any kind of exclamation mark.
Right.
They're just considered kind of things that happen, that they experience.
Right. Well, the one reason I like Zen, particularly, is that Zen doesn't emphasize that. It really doesn't emphasize that. I mean, I'm talking about this particular school. Now, some schools do. The Tibetan schools do, because they're grounded in a shamanistic practice, which is would be very close to, like, contemporary American Indians, because there's a real similarity. And so... if you were to ask a Tibetan about this, he's going to give you a very different answer than a Zen teacher is going to give you. The reason in Zen, and the reason I appreciate it so much, is because I remember a great story. Suzuki Rishi's, you know, walking across. It's like everyday magic. Every day, the more that we can be present and really open ourselves to the wonderment of the universe, but in some ways training our minds to be present, that's all the magic we need. That's all the magic we need, is just to see the apple blossom blooming in the spring as it is right now. It's doing. That's the magic that we want to cultivate. This very life that we have is enough. We don't need to do anything else.
Well,
so let me just finish. So that would be the Zen answer, right? Do these things exist?
Or did they exist? Yeah.
Well, I put them in the same category, for me personally, of like reincarnation. You know, for some Buddhists, this is an example, reincarnation is really a pivotal part of their practice. Like Tibetan Buddhism is really a pivotal part of their practice. And Zen is not so much a pivotal part of their practice. It isn't necessary to believe in reincarnation to be, you know, a serious practitioner in, you know, in our tradition, Zen tradition. Did these things exist?
Yeah.
I certainly don't discount it. Do I discount that I think people, their sense of sensitivity and their sense of understanding that things... that there were forces in life, you know, that are beyond the way we view things right now. I think that very possibly that's true. Abilities, for example, abilities of the siddhas to do time travel, things like that, which are examples in Tibetan Buddhism that people actually had that ability, you know, to do those kinds of magical things. The danger is that the ego can coalesce around anything, you know. It's dangerous. There's a potential danger in being able to create magical powers. That's why we tend in Zen, not that they don't exist, but there's the danger involved in doing that outweighs the advantage of being able to do it, of being able to perform miracles, so to speak. So I know I'm not quite touching your... And then you get into the newer teachings like the Lotus Sutra. A lot of the Mahayana Sutras are just replete with miracles, right? It's like all kinds of Buddhas from different world systems appearing. Why did they create this in these sutras, the Lotus Sutra? Does this really happen? No. It's this fantastical world that they're creating to create some state of mind that elevates you. And in fact, even Dogen today, and I don't know if we'll get to it today, but in time being, he begins to create a space that's very much like the Lotus Sutra. We're so locked into a narrow idea of what our potentiality is. We do not see ourselves as Buddha. We don't see ourselves as an unconditioned presence. We see ourselves very much as a conditioned small self. And we limit ourselves because of the vision of that. So a lot of the later sutras, like the Lotus Sutra, are trying to expand the vision of what's possible. And that's why in time being, Dogen is saying, again, he says, you think you're just this person, but you are a Buddha. See that you're linked to all Buddhas through this idea of time being. He's trying to put you into that. So he's actually trying to get you to expand your idea of, you could say, past births, reincarnations, but he's trying to get you to see that you're actually linked to everybody in the past. And you will be linked to everybody in the future. You're linked to everything because everything's linked to time being. Now, that may not sound so magical, but that's pretty magical, and that's reality. So, I know I haven't quite nailed your question. Do these things? I don't know. I haven't experienced them myself, but I certainly wouldn't discount that could have happened. And you also have to understand that it was also skillful means. A lot of these sutras were presented as a way to inspire people. And in that time and place, people were inspired by magic. And so, but basically, Buddha didn't emphasize magic too much. The early sutras, he really didn't, you know.
There's a couple of places he warned against it.
Yeah, he warned against it.
You could get yourself really off the wrong
path. Exactly. Right. You know. Exactly. Okay. Maybe that's is that good? Can you hold your questions for? I really appreciate this. I'll be thinking when, like your question, I'll be turning that question. Okay. So last week I was trying to share something with you about meditation practice, something very practical, and I was saying that one of the things that I hear again and again from people about why meditation practice is hard is because we don't think we're very good at it. We get discouraged. You know, we sit down and the mind just won't calm down. And so we think we're not doing it well and we want to leave the practice. But that idea of meditation is very limited. I know Suzuki Roshi said something once that was always very helpful to me. He said, you're not doing meditation. He said, you're not doing Zazen. Zazen is doing you. That's a different concept. In other words, I'm using this meditation thing to get something, rather than you're just submitting to this process. And by submitting to this process, let it do you. Throw yourself into something bigger. You know, give up this idea, you know, that you're supposed to necessarily get something out of it. Which is Dogen's whole idea of practice realization. That's what he's trying to get us out of, this gain-seeking mind that right now isn't where it's at, someplace else is where it's at. Right? He's trying to get you to just appreciate the totality of your life, everything that's ever happened to you. And that's what he's doing in time being. He's trying to get you to see, you think your time has passed. Remember when we were reading last week in section 7, do not think that time merely flies away. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is you think of time only as passing. In essence, here's the key phrase, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments, as time being. Because all moments are the time being, they are your time being. That's, to me, when I read that, it's just another way to describe, another way to understand what emptiness is, which is pretty hard to put in any kind of language, right? That's why we're trying to experience, have some experiential experience of that in our meditation practice. So Dogen, you know, there's a great early Zen story that I always like and I've shared but not for a while, where the two monks are walking along and they run across this lady by this raging river, but these are pretty sturdy monks, and so, and she can't get across, and so one of the monks picks her up, puts her on the shoulder, kind of like, you know, a St. Christopher story, if you remember St. Christopher, right, carries her across the river, sets her down, they go on their way, and the second monk, after a while, says to him, you know, you actually broke the rules of our order. You touched a woman. We're not supposed to touch women. And in the Theravadin tradition, that's true, even today. And the first monk, you know, looks at him and he says, I put that woman back down back at the river, and you're still carrying her. Which is what we do, right? We're always carrying this, you know, grievance or resentment or something forward. So the teaching here is, can you just let it go? Emphasize impermanence, and now's a fresh moment, right? One thing you know about Dogen is he isn't going to just take the traditional approach, because the phrase I just read you was, remember, he's saying, don't just think the past is finished. Realize that it continues to influence you. And we were talking last week of how important that is to bring those parts of yourself that were difficult or wounded, be able to work with them in the present moment. That's a very hopeful thing, that we can take those things, they will come through, they'll continue to get triggered, continue to use those things, but now with the perspective of your big mind. And that's what he's encouraging us to do. Don't think, you know, that you were deluded before and now you're enlightened, you're not going to be deluded. No, your life contains everything. You don't need to put anything out of your life. Continue to use your entire life. You know, your life is rich and whole, even the parts that seem painful. It's such an inclusive message. We don't have to be dualistic. Good now, bad then, you know. And I was trying to read something to you last week. Remember, I read you the wrong section. So I went back. Here was a section which I think relates to this. Again, the part that we have a hard time in meditation is because we don't do it very well. And we all want to be good people and do it right and just have this clear mind that's unconditioned and doesn't deal with all this past junk or future stuff, right? That's such a limited idea of time being, because your mind is going to include all this, right? So this is a section in the Lojong teachings about practice with distracted. Don't just practice when things are perfect. Don't just practice when your mind is clear. Oh, my mind's too confused today. I'm not going to finish my meditation. I might as well just get up and go fix breakfast. So practice when distracted. So here's Norman talking about his meditation, which should sound pretty familiar to you, which I think is beautiful and really coalesces with this idea of time being, that in your meditation, your whole life is going to come forward. So it's a little bit paradoxical. The instructions are, when thoughts come, drop them. Return to your breath. Drop them. Return to your breath. Begin to have an understanding of impermanence. Thoughts do quiet down. Your mind can become more quiet and expansive. But he says here, again, he says, there's another saying in Zen that I'm very fond of. When you fall down on the ground, you use the ground to get up. This is exactly what happens when you fall down. You use the ground for leverage to get up. You push off from the ground. Again, I can use myself as an example. I usually sit in meditation in the morning while alone in my house. For many years, I sat with others in official Zen meditation halls early in the morning. But now I consider my daily meditations relaxing and easygoing, a time of great ease and peacefulness. Sometimes in those early days, it was almost a little competitive, you know, we were all kind of performing, you know. We had to kind of sit enough hours to kind of get, try to get through that. As I sit now, my mind is often floating around like a cloud, this way and that way. Sometimes my mind is quiet and still, but a lot of times it's just floating like that. You might say, poor fellow, he's so distracted. Maybe I am. But on the other hand, to me, it seems a very beautiful thing to drift along with the mind that way, with all the various wonderful things that float into the mind and float out of the mind, with all the passions and thoughts and feelings, and with the various stains from my lifetime or someone else's lifetime. Sometimes it's not so clear whose. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be on the beam every moment. Discipline isn't like that. There is a time for hard focus and a time for soft focus. It's not that practice is directed, serious, and important, and that distractions are something else. Practice is life, including everything in your life. That's what Dogen's trying to say here with time being. Is everything in your life, even the distractions. When you think you're distracted, when you think you have forgotten about your practice, remember the slogan, practice when distracted. You may well be distracted, but that's nothing wrong with that. As soon as you know your state of distraction, you're practicing. You have remembered your practice, practice realization. Distraction, laziness, indulging in stuck emotions like anger, jealousy, and so on are all part of the practice. You fall down on the ground, you use the ground to get up. Using the ground to get up is remembering to notice the state you are in. As soon as you know your state, whatever that state is, you are practicing this slogan. You are practicing time being, being in the time being. You are back on the beam. You never actually lost track of it anyway. There is no distraction after all. So hopefully, and I think that's exactly what Dogen was trying to say and continues to say in this facet of time being. Do you like Barbara Kingsolver? She's pretty good, huh? I like her stuff. She was giving a 2012, she was giving a commencement address at Duke University about hope. And she said something here that kind of reminded me of time being a little bit. The arc of history is longer than human vision, bigger than we can imagine, time being. It bends. We abolished slavery. We granted universal suffrage. We have done hard things before. And every time it took a terrible fight between people who could not imagine changing the rules and those who said we already did. We have made the new world. We have made the world new. The hardest part will be to convince yourself of the possibility and hang on. If you run out of hope at the end of the day, to raise in the morning and put it on again with your shoes, hope is the only reason you won't give in. Burn what's left of the ship and go down with it. So she said to them, they said, what's the most important thing? She said, hope. Have some hope. Have some vision. And I was reading, again, Viktor Frankl's book. Wonderful book on the meaning, you know, the man's search for meaning, where he says the search for meaning or having this kind of hope is more important than just happiness. So she says the most important thing is to have this sense of hope, or Frankl would say, have this sense of meaning, something more meaningful in your life. And then she says the second thing is then to inhabit your hope, to have the hope. To have some vision of something that's bigger than your small self. To have the bodhisattva vow. I'd hold that out to you as a possibility for something of great hope and potentiality. And then try to live within that hope. Try to actualize that hope.